Court that, you know, it was just this wonderful thing, you know, and God really touched us, and we had these deep conversations. But we actually just kind of marveled at the level of gas that each other had. And I guess that was, you know, kind of reflective of this phase in life, 40 years later, you know, 60, and up in the mountains. No, nothing noble. Nothing noble. Yeah.
But Holden has shaped our lives because we were here as young adults embarking on our journey and our careers, and it was formative in our thinking. And I don't think we would have engaged to the level of humanitarian assistance and engaged in the concepts of disaster risk and building resilience in vulnerable communities over our lifetime that we wouldn't have done it to the degree that we are today because of how Holden shaped our thinking and the things that make for peace.
Yeah, yeah. John and Mary Schramm were formative in our lives. They were up here, they were directors at the time, and they were talking about social justice when there weren't a lot of people that were actually talking about social justice and actually figuring out what that would mean in life and how you would intentionally build that into your whole path. So maybe we should just talk a little bit about that as long as we have it on there. Yeah.
Okay.
We were encouraged, actually, we don't like to talk about ourselves, but we were encouraged, maybe we should, you know, that there's a story here, and maybe it's worth just giving something of a testimony or how we got to where we are now and where we, you know, hope to be going in the future. So it's maybe worthwhile talking a little bit about that, so forgive us on that, but we'd just like to share that story.
So I know there are a few people here from North Dakota or in the village from North Dakota. And I grew up in North Dakota. And a few months after we left Holden, we got married. And this is a testament to Steve's love that he and his family journeyed to North Dakota because nobody comes there. And I think one of the other instructors is from North Dakota, and she says her family never wants to come visit her.
Yeah. In keeping with Holden tradition also, I thought it would be appropriate to hop freights to go and visit her family in North Dakota. And my family said, yeah, maybe that's a bad idea. It's not a very good first impression showing up on a freight train. So I took the Greyhound bus instead, 44-hour trip. And ended up drinking some kind of hooch out of a bottle at the end of the trip with some guy that I don't know. That's what happens, you know, on those Greyhounds. But the reason I ended up getting here was at 20, I was a college dropout, didn't really know what I wanted to do, but got deeply involved in the refugee crisis in Southeast Asia. This was in the late 70s, and the Pol Pot had just been, had run rampage across Cambodia, and the genocide happened there. 6 million people in that country, probably 2 million people slaughtered by Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. The Vietnamese came in and squashed that, and all of a sudden these refugees were just pouring out. Of course, you know, put it back in context, it was after the Vietnam War, and of course some of the atrocities that happened in Cambodia and Laos, and the rest of the world wanted nothing to do with what was going on there. But for some reason, I thought, I needed to be there. And it was one of those things where I was compelled to be there. I had to be there. And nobody was interested in having a 20-year-old dropout come and work in the refugee camp. So bought a plane ticket and just went down there anyway. And 2 days later, found myself out on the border working in a volunteer program with the UN at a camp that had about 6,000 people in it. It was the second day it was open. Within 6 weeks, that camp grew to 130,000 people. And there was just a handful of us that were there that were running this thing. And the oldest guy in the camp, the guy who was managing, it was 25, I was 20, and we were just a ragtag group. And nobody really knew how to do this stuff. It was, we were just figuring it out on the fly. And we learned an awful lot about prayer, like real desperate prayer at that point, and humility. You know, in the way we approach these things and seeking advice wherever I could and just trying to figure these things out. But the reason we that is that, well, for two things. First of all, it led me a question deeper to understand that I could do some of these things, that it was in me, that it was in my blood, that it was who I was to work in these situations. Also, that social justice was a big part of the thing, and that there must be a better way, there must be a more systematic way to be able to approach these problems. Well, that time came to an end in Southeast Asia, and ended up back in the Los Angeles area, and my pastor said, maybe I need to go up to Holden Village and chill out a little bit, and kind of figure out what comes next.
He forgot to mention he was desperately ill.
Yeah, that too. as happens. So, got up here, and this place was just a much-needed rest and a time to reflect on things and to ponder what possibly could come next after that.
So shortly thereafter, when we got married, we embarked on the Pacific Crest Trail to just finish thinking and sorting out what's next together and where we wanted to go. It turned out the Pacific Crest Trail was a great adventure, but it was a really bad snow year. In fact, the John Muir Trail's segment, it's a 50-mile segment in Northern California, was closed that entire year. Nobody was allowed into the wilderness area there. So we started north of that and post-poled through 6 feet of snow for miles and miles and miles. Finally, we got to Middle Oregon about Three Sisters and said, I'm tired of losing the trail. It was brand new then, so it wasn't well marked. There were tree falls, 6 feet of snow everywhere. We were tired of it. So we came to Holden again.
Got to work on housekeeping, and once again, just got to engage a little bit deeper in what was going on here and how people were thinking about some of the things that were going on in the world. And once again, it was a time when we really needed it. We traveled a little bit more and then found ourselves once again in Southeast Asia this time.
But we should say, this was actually miraculous. So when we left Washington after that stay in Holden, we were about to get on a flight, and Steve got a message from his mother that we had been called by the UN if we would come work in this refugee situation. Oh. It was a hand of God. No, I have no idea how our CVs got into anybody's hands, but we were redirected back to Southeast Asia at that time.
Yeah, so that was great. We worked on a small island in the South China Sea, this time working with Vietnamese boat people that were still flowing out of Vietnam, and dealt with anti-piracy efforts that were still pretty strong in the South China Sea, worked on protection of the refugees and their rights within the refugee camp there, and of course made sure that we were able to support about 10,000 people on this small isolated island.
So while Steve was working for UNHCR and doing those components of the refugee humanitarian assistance in that camp, I worked for another UN agency, which is now International Organization for Migration, but back then it was ICM, Intergovernmental Committee for Migration. So looking at the beginnings, these were the beginnings of migration patterns caused by disruptions of global society. I did the public health component of it, ensuring everybody was healthy, vaccinated, and treated for anything before they were able to move on. And malnutrition for the children was dealt with before they moved on so that the trauma could be reduced.
Yeah. In the meantime, we had gone back and studied a bit more here and then down at Whitworth College back in Spokane, where they had a very similar kind of a bent and interest in social justice. But, you know, I'd like to report that all that knowledge, you know, better equipped us to be able to do this work. But in fact, it probably filled our heads a little bit more than it needed to. And in fact, probably lost some of that that pleading with God and that desperation for direction and the humility that really needs to come when you're doing that kind of work. You know, we got the work done, and I don't think anybody suffered unduly under our hands, but it was we did get the work done well.
Yeah, during that time, I had to deal with a malaria epidemic, and I barely knew what malaria was, being a Western nurse. So I had to make a trip out to a research station that was in another part of Malaysia to just learn from some of the scientists what it was and what could be done and how I could control it and help the people more. So it was a real learning experience, nothing that my training had prepared me for.
Yeah. We're dealing with other things too. You know, anti-piracy is a big part of our work in the South China Sea at that point. So identifying what had happened on these boats that were attacked, seeing if we could use some of the local police to help identify where some of these pirates actually were, and working alongside them and prosecuting them and taking them to trial and actually putting some in jail. So it wasn't the sort of thing that would endear you to the local population, but it was probably something that was necessary to be done. At one point in the work, I had a meeting with the number two government person, my counterpart at the camp, and we had just kind of a polite conversation over coffee, in which time he puts a gun down and he says, "Keep doing what you're doing and one of us is not leaving this place." Okay, that's how this is going to be, huh? Yeah. He was gone the next day. It was that sort of intimidation and that sort of challenge that, you know, is part and parcel of the work. It was then, but now it is far worse for people that are working in some of these remote settings, and particularly around conflict, where those that are working for the Red Cross and for other organizations that are, you know, supposedly out there serving are finding themselves under a lot of duress. So it's, again, the world's changing very quickly for those that are trying to help out there. But we should fast forward a bit. We ended up back in Los Angeles. I ended up working for the fire service there and developed a specialty around disaster, which is where we've really spent most of our time in recent years. We learned a lot. By then, it's the mid-90s. We had some riots in Los Angeles. We had the Northridge earthquake. We had some floods. We had a series of big fires. And we continued to learn more and more and more. I finished my master's degree at that point, and eventually a doctorate in policy. You know, just we tried to contribute to building this body of knowledge and more around the expertise that we needed to be able to work in some of these very challenging situations.
And I worked in Los Angeles Public Health, focusing on beginning in refugee resettlement programs and focusing on infectious disease control for the county of LA, which is its own country, and developed an expertise. I brought my expertise from malaria and TB from the refugee camps, but developed a further expertise in infectious disease control among all emerging infections that were raging across large populations, and subsequently got my master's degree in public health and focused on my expertise in infectious disease, and then 9/11 happened. At that time, if you recall, we had anthrax, bioterrorism incidents, and it was realized, oh my goodness, public health is part of a necessary response in emergencies. And so this is where our paths came together again, professionally, where I really had to start learning a lot about the foundations of emergency and crisis management from my dear spouse, and apply it to public health, and started writing and plans for response and how public health can be integrated better, and training all the people accordingly and integrating them more with the emergency services that were already in place, and discovered I loved that too, and went on to get my doctoral degree in public policy as well.
Yeah, so once again, we're working a lot together.
Now we teach together.
Yeah. A wise person told me one time, in the first third of your career, you're probably just figuring out how to do things. In the second, in the middle part, you're probably productive. You know, you're reaching that point where you can really get some things done. But you really need to be thinking about that last third of the career, which is where you're giving back. And you're putting everything you can back into that next generation. So that's really what we're about right now. For our sins, we find ourselves in universities. I say that facetiously, but it's it's a tough place to be for a person that's used to doing things. But it's still, it's a very necessary part of what we need to be doing at this point in this field. So we teach, we consult, we worked on a number of projects recently. We had a contract for FEMA helping to figure out what the workforce needs to look like in 2030 and beyond. So we did a next generation core competency project for them. So that's really reshaping the way we think about the emergency services in general and the kind of people that we want to build through higher education and the way we hire and fire and promote people in the field.
So I would like to say that our most recent, I think, experience that I'd like to share is the healing that we have seen take place recently. We were invited to be a part of a couple of Homeland Security events. You know, after 9/11 happened, the Department of Homeland Security was created, and it created a lot of animosity between the emergency management community and the other responding communities like public health preventions, because it was like this giant amoeba that just ate them up and consumed them. And so there was a great divide between these professions. Instead of working together, there was intense feeling and bitterness. But we were invited by a person who had served during 9/11 and he wrote the after action report, which is still securitized, but he had moved on and became the superintendent of a Christian public school, and my son attended that school, and he was actually instrumental, very importantly, in Elliot's life, and he invited us, because of our relationship, to join a couple Homeland Security events that were significant, and people were so amazed that we were there, and like, oh, maybe this hate is going away. And so we teamed up with some people and brought it to a new event this year. And we saw tremendous healing taking place. And I really have to credit the concepts that of things that make for peace and the things that bring healing there, that we were able to be instrumental in this.
Yeah. And another side of the Holden that we brought into our lives is community. And we've always engaged, you know, as deeply as we can in community. We had spent quite a bit of time overseas. Elliot was born overseas in New Zealand. But when we returned to LA, thought, well, let's build out a house that's large enough where we could really practice community and see how that could affect our family, our friends, and our neighborhood. So we built a fairly big place, and has been home to extended family, but also to people passing through that needed a long-term place to stay or a short-term place to stay. So Elliot got to grow up in the middle of all that and be shaped by that. But at one point, we had 22 people living in our house and sharing meals and sharing conversations and beers and just, you know, kind of a fantastic time for people to come together. And it's become something of a nerve center for some of this work we do. But again, once again, I came from holding this thing. What I want to leave you with, just on this side of our life, is that there's no roadmap out there for how you're going to engage in this kind of work, you know, as in most of the things that church is engaged in. We've got to work it out as we go along, you know. We work it out together, we work it out in prayer and through guidance and trial and error and mistakes and just being willing to give it a try and see what works, and hopefully, you know, it makes things a little better in some places.
But I will say, as we will iterate later, it's always about relationship.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we've come from. Right now, it's for me, it's time to just pull back for a little bit, something of a sabbatical, just to stop for a while and however long it takes and think about what it comes next. And we'll talk a little bit more about this, but you know, there's so many extreme challenges in front of the church, in front of the world we live in, and around how we govern. And we want to really figure out where we can be most strategic. So we're waiting on God and seeing what see what's in front of us.
So that was a long story.
Yeah, sorry about that. It'll make sense in this context, I think. What we want to do over the next three sessions is talk about the church and the world, and a troubled world, about disaster, what's causing this, how we could see it different through a systems perspective. And we're going to dive into that pretty heavily today, just talking about some of the risks that are out there and doing kind of an introduction to systems thinking about how we can look at these things and how we can apply a lot of that globally. We want to do session two on adaptation. What does governance look like? What does the church look like in the midst of that? What could our role be? And third, an exploration into how we as a church can start to position ourselves better to really make a difference out there in the world. Before we do that, can we pray? Thanks, God, for the time to come together in such a beautiful place to ponder these questions about who we are as a church and what we need to be in this troubled world, in this world where there's so many difficult things happening to so many people, but there's so many possibilities as well too. And how can we be a catalyst for those things to come together in a more positive way to make a difference in the lives of the people that are really hurting out there? And we ask, Lord, your inspiration, speak through each and every one of us, inspire us and help us to speak up and to throw ideas out there, but mostly to seek your will, Lord, in what it means to be the church in an increasingly troubled world. Amen.
Amen. So the teacher in me always has to have the objectives out there front. So these are objectives for today, and four objectives might be a lot. So we're going to be ambitious. We're going to describe what disaster risk is. We're going to identify some of the challenges that are underway. We're going to discuss those hyperconnectivity of those challenges and risks. And then hopefully we'll have time to introduce some systems thinking towards adaptation.
It's really meant to be a discussion about what's going on. So when something doesn't make sense to you, when you see a better way of looking at it, when you have a question, jump in there, please, and help us understand this better. I mean, we're journeying along this way here, too. We're learning from each other.
This is going to be an interactive session, so...
Yeah.
We're done talking.
Yeah, we're done talking. Here's the problem we got, and these are disaster trends, the impact of disaster across the U.S., and it's just meant to be a very rough idea of the escalation of the problem that we see. 2017 was the worst year of disasters in the U.S. until 2018 came along and eclipsed all of that. And we're not going to go into detail on this. I'm sure you're all well familiar with where the problems are. And it's much worse in a global scale. This is a fairly recent picture from ReliefWeb, which charts where the major disasters are occurring in the world. And this is the sort of thing that much of the world is facing. And you can see where the concentration of some of these problems are.
So while you saw the previous picture of the huge amount of disasters unprecedented in the United States, there's only one dot, and that represents how we've moved and concentrated risk and disaster to the areas that are poorest. And you can see, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and Central America and the Caribbean.
Can I ask a quick, so are all of those over there, is that because of poor infrastructure, or is that just because that's where it happens?
Let's hold the thought for just a minute, because we're going to do an exercise that I think will answer that question well.
But that's a great question.
Yeah.
What's the scope of what you consider disaster? Yeah.
Okay, we look at three different things, okay? We look at emergencies, which would be an event that we can handle with the resources that are available. Holden Village being able to handle a medical emergency, with some assistance from Yamsa. These are run-of-the-mill kind of things. A disaster typically is an event that requires extraordinary resources to be able to assist, to be able to deal with that. So when there was the big fire, the Wolverine fire here, and we had bring in resources from all around the country, that was a disaster. But it was something we could cope with within the resources available across the western U.S. to be able to manage that thing. we talk about a catastrophe, which is something that's just completely overwhelmed the resources that are available. And you have to look at very extraordinary means to be able to find your way out of that. So rather than putting a strict definition, you know, in terms of dollars or life lost or something like that, the disaster really is something that we can manage, but we just have to use some extraordinary means to be able to handle it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Question on that. So it, all three of yours talked about something kind of acute.
Yeah.
So something like a refugee crisis or the AIDS crisis would not be a disaster by those definitions.
Oh, it is, but there's rapid onset disaster and then there's slow moving disasters.
And both are part of your definition?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we're seeing some of the emergency management people across the country starting to be engaged much more in those kind of slow moving things.
Okay.
The water problem in Flint, Michigan, for example, became a very much an emergency management issue. The opioid crisis in Maryland is being addressed by some of the emergency management people. So it's not typically what we think of as a disaster, but the ability to work through different ways of being able to solve as a society is. And we think there's a lot of room for the church to be engaged much more deeply and more meaningfully and with a lot more vigor in some of these things too. But we'll talk about that more later.
So as a scholar, I like to start with definitions, at least as so we can kind of get our hand around the same thing that we're talking about. Disaster risk is comprised of really four different components. And depending on what those components are is how deeply in need or how deeply vulnerable we are to the disaster risk. So the hazard itself and the characteristics of that hazard, how that environment works, and how often the people that are there exposed to that hazard also influences a disaster risk. The vulnerability of the people in the community that are exposed to that hazard will increase the risk. So, for example, earthquakes have certain characteristics, but when there's a fault that runs right under, or multiplicity of faults that run right under a huge metropolitan area like Los Angeles, that makes us all very vulnerable, but particularly the people with less resources and access are going to be more vulnerable. How often we're exposed to it, though? A big earthquake hasn't happened in Los Angeles since the 90s, so we're not exposed that often. However, if you take a threat like, and contrast it to like wildfire, and how frequently that happens, and the frequency of exposure, how vulnerable populations are. If we take the Paradise Fire, for example, that wildland land interface, the characteristics of what that hazard could hold, and then Paradise was a retirement community, so it was a vulnerable community. They didn't have enough resources in place for warnings, and that was the tragedy that happened. And the capacity to respond and to recover. So that basically is the components that define what disaster risk is. You'll be there. Anyway, so there's three environments, and I'll just use our props here. There's three environments that interact together that we really focus on for disaster risk. There's the natural, and this answers your question, Verlon. There's the natural physical environment. So if there's earthquake faults, that lies in the natural physical garden. If you have big forests and they're dry and you've got dying trees, that's a wildfire risk in the natural environment. If you're an island in the Caribbean, that's the natural hazard there is hurricanes. So we consider the physical environment, what we know about those physical environments. If you live on the banks of the Mississippi, you know you're going to get a flood. So those are some of the natural things that exist in our world. The built environment is where we built our city. And our cities, our communities, and how well we've built them and what kind of resources that community has. And then there's the social environment. How have we structured our people environments? How have we organized ourselves, and what kind of resources does that community have in education and monetary and other social structures? Depends on the social structure. So each one of these environments has unique identifiers and unique characteristics, and then how they interact together is what will create a disaster. Disasters are not a natural thing. It is forbidden in our field to ever refer to it as a natural disaster, because they're all human generated.
And the good thing is, if they're socially constructed, if we built these things, it means we have opportunities to be able to fix it also. You know, we're of the view that we live in Los Angeles, we get big earthquakes there from time to time, but we're of the view that shouldn't devastate our city. It's going to cause a bit of damage. There's going to be residual risk that we just can't deal with. It's beyond our means, but it doesn't need to be a devastating event for people and for our economies and everything else that make our cities. More and more important as we move forward. Please.
So we were in Madison 35 or whatever years ago when the tornado hit Barneville, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And we were there the next day and we saw what had happened. Are you saying that's not a natural disaster? Is a tornado not a natural disaster?
It's a natural hazard.
Yeah.
But the disaster is the human component.
Okay.
How we built our cities, our towns, and the social structures that exist.
Okay. So when Lutheran Disaster Response came out of that, because everybody in the town, I mean, the church was wiped out, and everybody in the town, either their business or their house was damaged seriously, or a person was damaged, not very many people killed, but everybody in the town was affected, and so there wasn't, they needed help from outside all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
The systems that would ordinarily have helped one or two people, it was overwhelming.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's still a disaster, but it's not natural.
Yeah. In other words, we're not going to stop tornadoes.
Right.
You know, and they
That's
may be
I mean.
Increasing in severity and frequency.
Right.
There's ways that we can deal with it through warning systems, through better sheltering, through this kind of thing. Tornadoes are a very difficult one to deal with. We can minimize the damage to the city, but through stronger construction.
Right.
But that's our goal.
Even that doesn't do it if you're hit direct on.
Yeah, you get an F5 and right through your city, and there's going to be a lot of devastation.
Okay.
We see, you know, places like Joplin, Missouri, that bounced back incredibly well after that very, very devastating F5 that went through there.
So that's a tribute to the social and the built environment.
We think it's the strength in the social environment, particularly in the case of Joplin. You know, it probably wasn't as tough of a city as it could have been, you know, in terms of building construction and that type of thing. But the resilience they had in the social structures was incredible.
Okay.
When FEMA showed up 18 hours after that tornado hit, they said, "You guys got this thing. You're clearing the streets. You're mending this thing back together. It's going to be hard," and there were a lot of lives lost. Nevertheless, that resilience was very important.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Yeah. What we want to do is take a few minutes and gather into a few groups and look for a bit at these three environments: the natural environment, the built, and the social, and talk about how these things are changing. And bear with us for a few minutes on that, but if we can look at some of those big things that are changing out there and just start to list them, I think that's going to be helpful for us to understand better where our opportunities are as a church to start to engage more deeply in making things better. So we have these boards up here. Maybe what we'll do is just set them here, if you don't mind self-organizing into a few groups that can look at this. One is on the natural environment. The other's on the belt, the other's on the social. And just lay out whatever comes to your mind about changes that are going on in these different environments. And then we'll just take about 5 minutes to do that, and then we can start to make some sense out of what we figured out there.
Yeah, we can group them in different areas.
Yeah. In fact, move around if you want.
Go to the one you're most interested in.
Yeah. One you have some experience with. And let's just see what kind of things we can figure out there. What are the changes, the big global changes that are going on in these different areas, like the built environment?
What kind of things do you see that are making you uncomfortable? Why are we seeing so much polarization in our society? Why are we, you know, we've got climate change causing other things. So those are some of the broader topics, but you can get.
Yeah. These are good things, bad things, whatever just comes to mind. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Changes.
I think I'm going to position this one over here. And so if you're interested in the social environment, this is the group.
Yeah.
And if you're interested in the natural environment and by identifying those changes, that's over in that corner. And built environment over here.
Just about 5 minutes.
So, for example, in the built environment, Los Angeles is a really ugly city of 70s kind of infrastructure. And the beauty of the city, we used to think it was terrible, but the beauty of the city is because everything is always bad infrastructure, they have no problem with mowing it down and rebuilding.
Yeah.
And reinventing itself. So, the dominant industries have changed 4 times over the last 75 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Anyway.
That's an example of the built environment.
Yeah.
All right. And your groups might need to elect a...
Let's do another thing with that list.
Why are the changes so huge?
As you see up here, each one of those things that you've identified, some of these things can be positive changes, some can be negative. Some could be either, just depending on the context. Can you go through that list and just with an up arrow or a down arrow or sideways, just note whether this is a positive thing, negative. If you don't mind choosing somebody from your group that could just explain your list, and if we could bring the boards right up here, it'd help probably be able to talk about the three of them together. All right. Talk briefly about the natural environment. Great list there. Can you explain to us a few of the things that you identified there?
Is that group have a spokesperson?
I have to talk about it.
Okay.
I'm a spokesperson. And you'll notice that a lot of what we have on natural, there's aspects of social in there. It's hard to distinguish between the two. But we have wildfires, we have hurricanes. We have the whole notion about tragedy of the commons, where I want to use things like water, or my use of how I take care of the soil, I use it for the best purpose for me at the expense of the global maintaining and nurturing things like forests, things like water, things like how I use the land. So that's kind of a social, natural thing. Climate change, glaciers melting, all of these things are, again, with some social in there. Urbanization and this impact on nature and the natural world. We talked about ocean pollution, and we're hearing a lot about the plastics and the impact on sea animal life. Things of orcas and other wildlife that are facing challenges, severe challenges. The extinction, population shifts in density, which can be either positive or negative, depending on why and where. And also, I can't read the last.
Farming, seed diversity.
Yes, seed companies controlling which seeds are available and perhaps not allowing some seeds to be available. I didn't add that. But that was kind of our natural list, just to start.
Yeah. Yeah, in 5 minutes, identifying all that, yeah.
Yeah.
And brilliant. I really appreciate the way you've identified where some of these things. Urbanization, for example, bleeds over into the built environment, but it can be a positive or a negative depending on your perspective on this thing. Same with wildfires we've learned around Boulder. Thanks.
And population shifts can either move to social or built as well.
I really appreciate the brought up the tragedy of the commons, because we'll talk a lot about that in when we're talking about governance in the next session. But yeah, very big issue.
Maybe I would add, you know, geophysical things to the list. So you've got earthquakes and tsunami and volcano and things like that.
How about the built environment?
That's ours.
Yes.
We too started out with urbanization, and we could go either way. Urbanization concentrates density, which is bad sometimes for people, but it's also good for land use. Building where you should not was a big negative that we cited Houston, where people continue to rebuild. They take their flood insurance and build the same house again. Increase of renewable energy was a good use. Felt like that should be obvious, but maybe it isn't for everybody. But it kind of can take you off the grid if you need to be. Holden as an example. Increasing reliance on technology makes you vulnerable to technology going down, but is also good for things like early warnings on your cell phone of a big storm coming in or a tornado. The vulnerability of the energy grid, exceedingly scary, but the energy grid itself being a good thing. So if power goes out somewhere, you can re-grid it or redirect it. And then the last thing that was cited as a positive is the shared economy, Uber being an example of that, and other places where you can beg, borrow, and not steal things you need, but you don't have to have your own.
I could also see that the shared economy can be a negative. So there's positive and negative.
Example.
Yeah.
Just the allocation of resources, there's the haves and the have-nots, and that kind of thing. So it could go both directions.
Yeah. Well, Uber is a great example, though.
Uber's a great example of sharing.
Yeah.
But the people, the drivers
right.
are.
Yeah. We're working with, I do a lot with Red Cross, and we're working with Uber right now and helping them to understand how all those drivers could be trained up in first aid. They could carry AEDs, they could carry leaving supply kits, they can carry all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And they're out there when a disaster occurs. There's a lot of opportunity in this.
In fact, we saw during the Las Vegas mass shootings that Uber and some of these shared driving resources were ad hoc ambulances. Mm-hmm. They just self-volunteered.
Yeah, thanks for that. Please.
Uber is also part of the gig economy, which might be negative.
Yeah.
Because people have to piece together all sorts of jobs. There's no longer careers, there's no longer insurance, there's no longer pension programs, and Uber fits right in there with, well, what do you do if you need a few more dollars?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll work 50 hours a week,
mm-hmm.
and put in a dozen hours as an Uber driver.
Yeah. Radical change.
You're radical.
Yeah. How about on the social environment?
We started out listing what felt like more negatives, but as we went back, we found that some were both. So wealth disparity, definitely a negative. Tribalism and siloing of people with people like us can be a positive if that makes that group stronger, but not if it isolates us. Individualism. Is we said was both could mean that someone was going off to create change in a positive way, but it could also mean more isolation. Secularization we said was both because it could mean that people of many faith backgrounds are working together rather than at cross purposes, but also can weaken those. Institutions. Internet and social networking definitely can go both ways. Mobility, similar to the urbanization and I can't remember what the other one was that natural had, similar positives and negatives to that. Failure of institutions, definitely a negative. Access to education was originally stated as the disparate levels of access to education, so that would be definitely a negative, but we talked about how across the world there's definitely people who have more access now, so that's a positive, and the internet is part of that. Fox News and disinformation, definitely a negative, and other sources of that. Migration and mobility are similar in that I would say positive and negative. And then access to healthcare,
like education could go both ways if people have it. If people don't, like many in our society, it's negative. Culture of boundaries, we said, like the response to a disaster may be limited based on cultural boundaries, or interactions between communities could be positive if people are crossing those boundaries and understanding each other. And our last one, I can't remember what it was. Oh yeah, the military-industrial complex. We didn't talk positive or negative there, but I would guess it's a negative because it is taking up so many of our resources.
I would say that there's a positive aspect of that because a lot of military can be deployed to help with disaster. And also the whole model of managing things comes from a military structure with someone at the head, because communication in a disaster is one of the biggest problems, and having a command structure or some way to handle that is important, I think.
The other thing that we're seeing with the military right now, and without getting into the roots of climate change, the military takes climate shifts more seriously than just about anything else out there. As they know, I mean, globally, if we don't deal with this, as we've seen in Syria and other places where climate issues have degraded into a conflict, we're going to be dealing with a lot of urban warfare. Plus, there's going to be degradations to bases and everything else. So they take it incredibly seriously. Yeah, thanks for that. Great list and very insightful. Again, disaster is socially constructed, and we can see it's the interaction between the natural environment, the built environment, and the social environment that ends up creating the disaster. And we can look at all these sort of global shifts, these big things that are going on, but these also have very local implications, as does disaster. Disasters are hyper-local events when it comes right down to it. We see across the West, for example, wildfire problem that's just escalating beyond control. You drive across the West and you see the amount of dead trees in these once healthy forests, and it's distressing when you realize where this is going to go, and we're not necessarily dealing with it. But you know, we've experienced this at Holden, and it's hard to stop wildfire, and we know there's very positive aspects to it. Holden's been very deliberate and intentional about how it's created a built environment here that's somewhat resistant to fire overwhelming it, you know, with the high pressure sprinkler systems and the way the buildings are constructed and the very careful warning systems that are put in place, as well as the social systems with people that are well trained and understand the wildfire risk and doing everything that they can to prevent it. So here at this very local level, we're seeing this wildfire problem that's being dealt with very constructively and continuing to do so. I understand there's more plans to further bolster what's going on here. So it's always these three interacting, the natural, the belt, and the social. But here's where we can have big impact as a church. This is our opportunity to engage at the local level without thinking about disparities involved and, you know, all those kind of big issues that are out there. These are things that we can deal with, you know. We can deal with the problems of isolation in different communities, poor communities in particular, and how we can engage more closely with them and help them to build the resilience they need to the bigger problems, depending on where they're located and how they're going to be impacted by disaster. But we can deal with all these kind of things.
I would just add a minor correction. While the church at the individual and social level cannot deal with the wealth disparities that are occurring structurally, we can be the helpers that bring in and help build the resilience of the poor. And in fact, we've been asked to, by Jesus, to engage with the poor.
Another example, cultural boundaries here too, you know, by the way we're able to engage through the church across our neighborhoods, it builds those networks and it builds the social structures, the real resilience to dealing with some of these other problems. The built environment as well too, we have opportunities to engage there when we're creative about it. And we'll talk a lot more about that, but the way we can influence policy at the local level, like we can insist for different building codes or better land use measures or those sort of structural things that can allow us to get out of the, maybe not fully out of the way of a hazard, but at least to minimize its impact on people.
Some of the changes that are taking place, both in the natural and built environments, and the uncertainties that are happening because there are shifts in our climate, there are changes in our urban structures, that influences and creates some of this isolationism, some of the popularism, and some of the disinformation and the silos. These are the interactions that create some of those uncomfortable spaces that we find ourselves in that we can reverse engineer. But all those uncertainties that work together leave people feeling very uncomfortable, and we're in an uncomfortable place as society, and that's why we wanted to highlight uncertainty. So when we have these kind of changes and the interactions between all these changes, and we are uncertain how that is going to play out, so we can't plan for every single scenario that may happen, we have to realize that surprise is the new normal.
So here's some lists that we came up with in a few minutes, and you can imagine how all these factors are going to start interacting with each other at a local level in ways which are very hard to anticipate right now.
So some of this came out of a recent United Nations Disaster Risk Reduction Report, where 100 scholars from around the world contributed to this information. But there's probable cascading failures. If one event happens, because of the interconnectivity of our society and of these space environment spaces, we're going to have cascading failures. And Japan's earthquake from 2010 is a really good example of this, where they had an earthquake followed by that enormous tsunami, which then affected the power plant that wasn't adequately prepared, and they had their generators in the wrong place and got flooded out, and so then there was a nuclear meltdown and continued ongoing health issues. So the cascading failures continue to happen over time now from that event. And we will see more things like that, where these interrelationships cascade to a place that is very uncomfortable unless we intervene and start making some social changes.
Does that make sense? Yes. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? This is the world we're moving into very rapidly. Here's how we've tried to deal with it in the past. You know, we've taken these mechanisms and we built one machine that just gets increasingly complex.
Complicated, not complex.
Yeah, sorry, complicated. And not necessarily up to dealing with the real problems at hand.
On the other hand, this is a strand of DNA. It's incredibly complex, but it's beautiful and it's patterned and it's got fingerprint, right? So it is, the complexity is there, but it functions in a way, unique way. And one of my favorite authors, who's a physicist, Fritjof Capra, has migrated over to the social sciences and tried to help social scientists understand some of the things they've learned from quantum physics, and that the patterns of all life are networks. Even our DNA is a network. And that's an important thing to understand as we go forward for finding resolution, finding solutions, working together as a community.
Yeah. I heard Fritjof Capra speak in 1977, before I dropped out of university. And I was taken by his insight that God has somehow created the universe with patterns that continually replicate themselves. And it started to make more sense as we dove deeper and deeper into this problem of disaster. It really came to a head when after the Northbridge earthquake, I was working with a scholar named Louise Comfort, and she started talking about complexity and complex adaptive systems. And it started to really make sense to me, once again, that nature was replicating itself over and over and over again, and whether it be in social systems that we operate in, or all the way down to the cellular level, if we understood those patterns better, we could be a lot more effective in how we intervened. Unfortunately, we too often have, you know, just kept building this complex machinery instead of
complicated.
She keeps me. Yeah, we keep building these machines instead of working better.
So I've heard this talked about in terms of three different kinds of problems. There are technical problems. So if you follow a recipe, even if you've never made a pie, if you follow a recipe, there's reasonable predictability it'll turn out what it's supposed to. Then there are complicated problems like going to the moon. If you can keep all the solutions, all the thousands of things in place, you can probably go back there again.
Yeah.
And then there are complex problems that keep changing. And as you solve one thing, they have unintended consequences, and there's adaptations.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
That was a good pearl.
Margaret Wheatley talks about it in these terms. This is not the real world. The real world is man-made dangerous fiction that destroys our capacity to deal well with what's going on. The real world demands that we cope with chaos, that we understand what motivates humans, that we adopt strategies and behaviors that lead to order, not more chaos. I think, to your point, it's a different way of approaching these very complex problems.
And if you go back to the DNA strand as an example of complex, it has order, but yet it's unique. So a few characteristics of systems. As we said, networks form the pattern of life. And so a system is comprised of networks. And these networks are interactive, they're interdependent, they can be nested, and they're dynamic, always changing. So these are the basic characteristics of a system.
Yeah, a moonshot's relatively predictable, but yeah, how we're going to interact after a disaster has got so many variables that we can't anticipate, or the unknown unknowns.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about network patterns. So this is a social network pattern that you can see pretty commonly. We tend to sometimes think of things in hierarchy, and even the military has learned that they can't function in hierarchy any longer. So they have a much more networked application of how they function. The central nodes are usually the key central players, the figureheads, but their role has changed. Their role is now as a central node to make sure information is constantly going out from them, that they're constantly diffusing information. Then you see ones that are, everybody's connected in some way, but not everybody is connected. Some are smaller and some are more peripheral. The peripheral nodes to this network are weak ties, but weak ties have a really important role that has been proved scientifically because they are the connectors to other networks. And as they become nested and embedded together, we find the church and our relationships are the weak ties, the peripheral ones. We're connected to a multiplicity of communities, and that's the most important role in diffusing the information. So the information from this network will come out from the central node and get diffused out. But then, if you're a weak tie to this network, you're connected to maybe five other networks. And that information flows through you to another five networks, and then that information comes in. And that is a very important concept in a social science relationship. Each one of these red dots are people. It's always about relationship. Relationship and information flows are the lines. And that's an important thing. Globally, we're connected through our information communication structure. our whole social structure has shifted over the last 30 years, and we've been going through the growth pains of that. The networked nature of our communication structure now has made us local, global. And what we are seeing with some of our social changes and the polarization is the reduced relevance of our nations, our nation states, that way of defining how we are bounded together and separated. We are much more like this globally now. So we're, while a disaster happens locally, we're connected to the global and we can get resources and help and assistance that way. Unfortunately, just like our computers, a network is binary. You're either in or you're out. And so our role as a church to consider is how do we bring those who are out in so that they have the information for adaptation and survival as well.
Does that make sense?
There is this factor of nationalism that's coming into this.
Yeah.
And it's breaking those network connections.
Yeah.
Just like our president is pulling us out of the climate accord. And
Yeah. We wrote on this about 4 years ago about some of the global shifts that were going on. And if you looked at the global, the national, and the local, we saw at that point the nation state withdrawing as the local became far more important. That made sense. That's where the real estate is, that's where business happens, that's where companies are going to locate, that's where people live. The action's local and regional. But at the global level, it facilitates us being able to tie all those things together, right? You know, through transportation networks, communications networks, all kinds of different important things. And the nation state assuming more of a strategic role. And we thought, that's good. Yeah, published on it, made sense, you know, it was starting to help us understand the shifts in the world until 2016. And then, how did this happen, all right? With populism, with nationalism, and very uneven how this is coming. But it could be viewed either...
Flip side.
Yeah, it's a flip side. It could be viewed as a nation state in struggling to refine its role. You see places like the Philippines and Brazil and certainly China right now, they're really becoming very authoritarian and asserting themselves in tough ways. We'll see where this thing all unfolds and how that works itself out. But we're struggling with this right now. And what kind of a world we move into, we don't know. And how the church can influence that is another thing altogether.
It's really one of the reasons this is all occurring is it's a backlash to that in and out, the changing role and not realizing what the new role is at that level.
Yeah. And yeah, we've achieved unprecedented peace and prosperity across the world. Lots of problems across the environment and equity and everything else, but at the same time, less violence, more people coming out of poverty, and now this system that has served us reasonably well is being torn apart. And you know, what is our role in you know, finding and making sense out of whatever comes next that we need to work through? What are your thoughts?
As always, religion can be the best of things and the worst of things. And we can be the solution, but then I see places like India where they're turning to Hindu nationalism and all the problems that comes with things like that.
Yeah.
So, the church can be a positive influence. It can also be a negative influence.
Yeah.
I'm also concerned because we're putting, at least the way you're talking so far, putting a lot of emphasis on the church. And the church's people is continually decreasing. There are fewer attenders, much less members. And so we're putting more work on fewer folks in the pews or wherever.
Mm.
Very good point.
Yeah, please.
And I think that plays into how do we develop the church as a dynamic body that can be more welcoming and accepting and attract younger generations and people from more diverse backgrounds, because it can't be the same group of people, as you said, and how do we expand beyond to welcome all and really
Yeah. Yeah, we serve the creator of the universe, you know, that understands these things, this world we're moving into. Go on, please.
The church is a very simple construct. And this is way beyond anything that the church talks about or knows about.
Of course, we're getting.
Well, I'm just saying, it just seems interesting that I'm just not sure how the church will ever get to this point to understand this kind of stuff. I mean, who's other than you two?
Yeah.
Who's talking to the church? Who's teaching the church? Who's bringing this into the church?
Yeah.
Most pastors aren't here.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. I think they should be. I'll just put it on the ground. Yeah, I think we need to be able to function at this level and much higher.
Maybe you don't need to understand systems thinking, but we're presenting a systems perspective as a tool to better understand our risks and to better understand where are the points that we can maybe be part of the solution, but it's always about relationship.
So you would argue
it
that
can come down as simple church, as relationship.
Church training for new pastors is going to have to change as the world changes?
Well, I would say maybe not for the pastors,
yeah,
but you know, for the church to facilitate members that are willing to go out there and engage in deeper and deeper levels.
Yeah.
And you know, we have a history of it, you know, with Joseph, you know, working at high levels in government and averting catastrophe.
Mm-hmm.
With Daniel,
yeah,
you know, the judge, the righteous yeah. judge moving in and assuming high levels in government. And I think we've set the bar maybe too low. And
maybe the Bible study on Jonah is really relevant to this question.
Yeah. What's fascinating...
Because he was abdicating his role.
Yeah.
That he was asked to go mm-hmm. intervene.
That's true.
Prevent destruction.
Yeah. I'll tell you the dirty little secret of our work, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's really pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's pretty straightforward stuff. And when you start talking about these constructs and complexity and governance and all that, but the more you dive into it, really is pretty straightforward, and it's a question of the relationships and the mindset and the idea that we can bring positive change into our communities, to our neighborhoods, to the local level. We're not necessarily, you know, solving the big global right. issues that are out there, but we can work constructively at the local level and network ourselves together as a church in a way that we can support each other in ways that we haven't even envisioned yet and bring about some change.
Exactly. You know, the people in this group identified a number of those points where the church can be help with reducing isolation of people. It can help with access. They can, by being advocates, they can help with reducing silos and tribalism, but really that reaching out. I do want to really highlight on this slide, when we start understanding complex risks and the interactivity of all these things, the people who suffer most, who get, are the vulnerable, because the layers of risk, as you saw in the very first map, where the disasters happen, are always where the most vulnerable. The people who have the least resources exist. And that's a really important thing to remember. And this is central to the church's role, really, that we are looking to the least of these and reaching out and giving a helping hand. And that's always been the church's role. And we shouldn't forget that. So this came out of the United Nations Global Assessment Report just a month ago, that location, age, gender, income group, disability, and access or benefit from social protection schemes and safety nets greatly affects the choices people have to be able to anticipate, prevent, or mitigate the risks that they face in their local community. So the less resources, the less access you have, the more you're going to be impacted by a disaster of any nature.
I love the theme for this this summer, the unity of love. And I think Cornel West expressed this beautifully, that justice is what love looks like in public. And some of these questions that we're talking about may be a lot of tough love, and it may be deep engagement with the church, and it may be the church partnering with all kinds of other faith communities or with companies or people you don't even expect. Mm-hmm. But it, I think it's deep, deep engagement.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking along those lines, like the church is fine, but what about the dialogue between science and religion? It seems like there's still very much a divide, and I think science is a partner in this as well. So what's your views on that, and what kind of dialogues are taking place there?
Yeah, science is just an honest pursuit of the truth. You know, how did God create this thing that's in front of us, and how can we understand it better and work with it? And it's a systematic way of doing that. And I think that's a beautiful expression of the church and how it lives and how it does stewardship, in particularly in challenging times. So I don't understand where there's a gulf between the two.
Currently, and I was smart enough to understand the math and the physics behind the love, but the current physics are progressing to the point where string theory is proving the existence of God, and scientists are really better understanding this. And I think it's really interesting that our science is coming full circle this way.
Yeah.
But I'm a social science person.
What are your thoughts on it? How do we use science as we start to approach some of these big problems, and particularly as a church, how do we engage more deeply with the science community?
And for me, it's both and.
Yeah.
It's both and. That there is things to be learned from science and not go in the direction of religion, but there is a tension that's held there.
Mm-hmm.
That I think there is string theory and a number of things that are pointing to that Big Bang creation thing. But I think when we tend to ignore some facts because we want to believe something else or vice versa, I think is when we kind of go off the rails.
Yeah.
So it feels like, to me, it's like a both and.
Mm. It's the pursuit of truth.
Well, and then the third component in the science religion is the politics. That if you're this kind of a Christian, you believe this kind of science. And if you're another kind of Christian, you believe the other science.
Yeah.
How climate change got politicized as well as religiousized is just bizarre.
It is. It is.
And what's the point again of that? Of politicizing stuff?
That's
power, follow the money.
Power money?
Control.
What do you think?
Yeah, it's control.
Yeah. Control?
Yeah.
Yeah. And here we are stewards, you know. This beautiful creation has been left in our hands. And, to serve a God of mercy and justice when all these things are crumbling around us, you know. How do we find meaning in that? How do we come together? How do we do this in a way that's truly going to have impact?
Yeah, I think it's always about power and control, and I think the reason is Richard Rohr has a saying I like that he says, when the going gets tough, the rich go on vacation.
Yeah.
So true.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and watch out when a lot of these disasters, these catastrophes start coming home to roost, you know, and, they're not the ones that get nailed. It's the poor guy that lives in a slum in India with his family and has no options.
Or the Ninth Ward in New Orleans.
The Ninth Ward in New Orleans.
Yet the Gates Foundation is doing what they can over and above any of the rest of us. They're small 1%, which is huge. If they're able to spread their dollars to help many different.
Yeah.
So your point is an interesting one, but they are and can help too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Phenomenal work going on. And we'll talk more about that, some of these points of light that we haven't really been looking at before, but Gates is doing phenomenal work.
Yeah.
Rockefeller Foundation dropped $100 million on these questions. The Atlantic Council, some friends of ours, they're putting another $100 million in climate issues.
Right.
And that's coming out of a conservative think tank.
Yeah.
They're looking at climate issues. So how do we understand these things that are going on and help better inform that? But anyway, the next couple of sessions, we want to dive a lot more deeply into this and look more at complex adaptive systems and governance. And where are the entry points when we start looking at governance at the local level? How can we as a church engage and really make a difference? Where's that point where we can actually dive in there? And then, as we've talked about for a few minutes now.
I think governance is a scary word for most people, so mm-hmm. let's just redefine it as the way we organize ourselves.
Yeah, and it's all the ways we organize ourselves. It's not just government, but it's how the church does, it's how schools engage, community organizations, all that. Where are those entry points for us to be able to make a difference on these very difficult issues? And then we'd like to carry on this discussion about the church and, you know, with the church that's not everything that it could be right now. How can we better be effective in this troubled world? So anyway, thank you very much.
That was a plug for our next two sessions, but I'd also like to highlight Brillon's sessions this week. Because they really connect very nicely.
Yeah.
The homeless component, the racism component are really important to get our heads around as we're trying to intervene in these issues and reduce vulnerability and build resilience in our communities.
And there's a couple other sessions that are coming up also on how the church repositions itself. And it should be a fascinating week, and it's amazing how this has all come together by design. By the hand of God, I don't know, but it's brilliant. A lot of discussion really about what the future of the church needs to look like. So anyway, thank you very much for helping out. Appreciate
it. Thank you.